Welcome to MTG Pro Tutor, your gathering of insights, tips, and advice from renowned players and community icons. Connect with venerated teachers to gain the knowledge you need to improve your skills. Now, here's your planar guide and personal tutor, Sean Penrod.
Prodigies, welcome to episode 280 of the MTG Pro Tutor Podcast. I am Sean of The Gathering, your host. So happy that you are here today. And I want to say thank you to Paragon City Games for supporting the show. And I want to say thank you to you, the listeners of the show, for making this possible, especially the patrons who keep the lights on and keep things going. And I will be announcing the winner of the patron-exclusive March giveaway at the end of the episode. So if you're a patron, stay tuned to see if it's you. And if you're not a patron, then head on over to mtgprotutor.com/Patreon, where you can learn more about that program and sign up to support the show directly. If you feel I've earned it, if you like the show and you find it valuable, and you feel that I've earned your support, then mtgprotutor.com/Patreon is one way that you can give back. I also want to say thank you to Paragon City Games. They provide the prize support for these giveaways, as well as the prize support for the Sealed League that we do each and every set. We just recently wrapped up the Rivals of Ixalan Sealed League, just in time for Dominaria here around the corner. And I want to congratulate Sam Ruin, who took it down, and he will be getting a Rivals of Ixalan bundle provided by Paragon City Games. But every player in the top 8 gets a prize. They get credit for the next league, redeemable in ticks, cash, or credit. So congratulations to everyone who made the top 8, and thank you to everyone who participated and played. I love participating in the leagues and getting in there and playing with you prodigies, and I look forward to more people joining us for the Dominaria one. So I know last weekend there were 2 Grand Prix in Seattle. Did you go? I'm reviving the hunt for listeners turned guests. I really want you to put out there your goals in Magic and let me know how I can help you achieve them, because I'd love to feature you on the show. And one of the best ways to do that is to qualify for the Pro Tour, making it to the top 8 of a Grand Prix, or taking down an RPTQ. So let me know about your journeys and what you're working on and how your exploits in Magic are going. I always love to hear about them and help where I can. So congrats to everyone who went to the 2 Grand Prix up in Seattle, and good luck to everyone going to the Grand Prix this weekend. Now, I've done a lot of interviews with some great players recently, and I've really loved diving into sportsmanship, dedication, and respect. And we'd love to carry on that conversation with you today with our guests. So let's bring them in, sit down, and talk about Magic. What's up, everybody? I'm really excited to have our guest with us today. Our guest is a former PTQ grinder who has 6 Pro Tour appearances. He took a hiatus from Magic and came back in 2017 to finish 10th at GP Amsterdam, and recently got his first Grand Prix top 8. Coming to us from Koblenz, Germany, prodigies near and far, let's welcome the one, the only, Alexander Quartz. Alexander, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very good, thank you.
Excellent. Are you ready to delve into your mind and share with the audience tips and tricks to take the game to the next level?
Of course, I'll do what I can.
Excellent. Now, prodigies out there, if you want to connect with Alex, we are going to get him into the Prodigy Facebook group. So if you're not a member there, then go ahead and join. It's mtgpro2.com/Facebook group. It'll redirect you to our group. And once you're in there, you can make a post, tag Alex in there, and say thanks for being on the show, ask him a question. But that's the best place to find him online. So, Alex, let's talk about you outside of Magic before we do the Magic stuff. Are you born and raised in Koblenz?
Yes, close to Koblenz, in a very small town with only like 100 inhabitants.
Wow.
But I've been living my life basically at my parents' place until I made an apprenticeship. And from there on, when I was like 19 or 20, I moved out to Koblenz and started studying and working and playing Magic, of course.
And so are you working now? Do you do school? Like, what do you do?
Yes, I'm working as an employee in the financial business. I'm doing insurances, finances, house building. Like, if people want to buy a house, I can give them money.
Home loans and stuff?
Yeah, exactly. Loans, yes. That's like everything about finance, basically.
Cool. So you're doing that and then also playing Magic. And growing up, did you play games with your siblings? Do you have siblings? Like, tell us about like where your love for gaming came from.
Yeah, I was into gaming in all different kinds basically all of my life. I've started playing Magic in the 5th grade as a child. Then we actually had a group of people around there who made their own tournaments. And while playing in there, I realized that there's a lot of depth in the game, a lot of strategy, and also like big tournaments where you can go and win big prizes, which were actually the PTQs back then. And from there on, when I figured that if I only win one of these, I can win a flight and have a chance to travel around the world. I was really into it, and then I started grinding.
Excellent. So on that note, can you take us back in time and tell us the story of the first time you ever saw or played with Magic cards?
The first time? That was probably in fifth grade, when I was like 11 or 12. A friend of mine just had some Magic cards, and I thought the pictures are like really cool. And then we started playing in the breaks during school.
And what was your first set? Do you remember?
The first set I ever had a Magic card in my hand, or the first set I really played then?
The first set you ever held, remember?
I ever held. I know what the first cards I really owned were.
Okay, yeah, we'll go with that.
Sixth edition starter.
Oh, a sixth edition starter, excellent. Anything good?
Sixth or seventh, I don't mind. It was like the foil rocks that was in every starter. Like, this was a starting pack for players with two pre-built decks where you can read the rules. A blue-white and I think a green-black deck. And then you could play against each other. And the best card was the foil rocks that was in there.
Nice. So since you started playing, and I know that you've been in and out with many players, and that's fine, what's been your favorite set?
For limited or for constructed?
Either one, whatever comes to mind.
Okay, my favorite limited set was that. Pooh, there were a lot of good ones. Probably the Alara block.
Yeah.
Maybe also Ravnica, it's one of these. Or Timesburger was also really great, I can't really decide. And the best constructed formats were every constructed format that had the old Ravnica in it, even with Kamigawa or later on with Timesburger, these were like the best.
Old Ravnica, excellent.
Yeah, there was like tons of decks, different decks. You could play everything, everything really balanced. Every part of the game, like combo decks were good, like Heartbeat of Spring. There were aggro decks, there were control decks, mid-range decks, basically everything. And it was a good time to learn.
And along the same lines, what is one of your favorite cards?
My favorite card probably is, since I actually started to play competitive with Vintage back then, when the Vintage scene was good, I like Gifts Ungiven.
Gifts Ungiven, nice. So, for those of us who don't know, what is it, what does it do, and why do you like it?
Gifts Ungiven is a 4-mana blue instant. It costs 3 and a blue, and it makes you search your library for up to 4 cards. That's especially relevant. And then you give these 4 different named cards. You give these cards to your opponent, and he has to put 2 of them in the graveyard, and you get the rest into your hand. And you can do a lot of cool tricks with that card.
Yeah, like not look up 4 cards, you can just get 2 or whatever.
Maybe a relevant example for Modern even. If you go ahead and give some given for just 2 cards, say Unburial Rites and Iona, Shield of Emeria, your opponent has to put both of them into the graveyard, and then the turn thereafter you can just reanimate the Iona.
Sounds pretty good.
That's an easy trick.
Yeah, I like that.
But there are like a lot of more cool tricks you can do with Gifts Ungiven.
That's fun. Oh man, that's great. Love kind of hearing, you know, the first couple sets that you played. And as you started playing more, tell us about the transition to competitive. So, you know, obviously everyone starts and they're kind of casual and doing their thing. But then when did you start being a little bit more competitive with Magic?
Like, the competitiveness started before I played PTQs, because we had like local tournaments where you had like where you could win some prizes playing against local people, and that was already pretty competitive because everybody wanted to win.
Yeah.
We had tournaments in every given format back then, in Standard, it was Extended, Vintage, Legacy, and we played there. And from then on, I realized that I am like better than most of the people I played against there, and I was winning on a very high rate. So I started to look for tournaments with bigger competition.
And when you were going through that process, what was a struggle that you faced, but that you eventually overcame?
The struggle really began when I was playing PTQs, because the thing was, I started playing PTQs at first, of course, with not that big of success, and I realized that I have like a lot of things to learn. And I think the most difficult thing is, especially if you're doing it on your own, is getting to figure out how to learn, how to get better at the game, and yeah, what to do then. And after the struggle during that time was that I like started top eighting. I actually won the first top eight I made, beating Jelga Vigas in the quarterfinals. That was pretty funny. But after that, I made like a huge number of great PTQ top eights without ever winning again, like over 1.5 years. And I actually have a, I've looked it up. I have like a pretty sick rate at PTQs, conversion to top eight and wins. And the struggle was like to always keep yourself motivated and to still keep yourself better, because bad luck happens to everybody. And it's especially sad if you are like having good luck in the Swiss and then you are getting your like two mulligan or double screw games in the top eight where it really matters. And I think getting your mindset right on these and learning that you should not be upset about bad luck, but you should be upset about when you are actually making a mistake and losing games that you should have won, if you would have just played them better. That is like the biggest struggle. Realizing that and getting your mindset right helps a lot in getting like more successful.
Wow. So what helped you kind of realize that?
Yeah, first of all, I talked to better players. That's like basically the most important thing you always have to do. If you want to get better at the game, play against someone who is playing better than you and ask him to give you advice. Because if you're playing against people that are actually worse than you or probably on the same level, you're learning much slower. You have to pick up things that actually happen to you, and you also have to keep track when you're playing in a tournament, let's say, against an opponent, and he actually makes a really good play against you. You have to keep this play in mind. You have to remember yourself, and you have to like adapt and always pick these like small things up and add them into your own game. That's how you get better.
And yeah,
I could like make some examples if that helps.
Yeah, I was gonna say. So I love the advice of talking to people who are better than you. But please share some examples so we can draw from that as well.
For example, maybe you know Simon Goertzen. Back in the time, he was like in my group of players. We tested for German nationals, for PTQs, stuff like that, or even for the Pro Tour. And I played against Simon for the match for top eight at the PTQ in the cruel control mirror match. It was a really drawn out control match. And I believe that the first game actually was won purely because he was just outplaying me on multiple sides. For example, he did things like flashing in plume veils at the end of my turn instead of discarding, but only when he didn't have another land in hand, so he doesn't lose the 7 card point of the game. And after that, like having like 10 turns later, having 3 plume veils in the deck, he played the 5-mana Wrath of God that puts the creatures on the bottom of the library in order to have the plume veils back in his library to not get decked. Huh. And then in the relevant turn, when we both had like 7 cards and it was obvious that like my 7 or 6 cards were like all good, he started Esper Charming me at end of turn, making me discard cards in order to win a counter battle on his own turn. And that was like, the entire game was like about 20 turns all planned from him, that I will be like 2 cards down at the end and then lose the most important battle of the game. Yeah, and that was, there I learned something. I learned that like if the games are really drawn out and really long, you can have a long-term plan and you have to stick to it.
That's really cool. Yeah. And that's good that you observed that and were able to absorb it and learn it. And that's really, really neat. So what would you say to a player who might be in a similar situation? They're starting to get competitive, and you know, try to pick up on things here and there. What would you share with them that you learned from your experience that can help them?
If they want to get better, if they want to learn something, how to do that? Is that the question?
Yeah. So someone who's starting to get competitive, advice would you give to them who is going through a similar situation where you were?
Yeah. First thing. Play Magic Online. The players on Magic Online are way better than the players you are usually meeting at home, at least when you are playing like a bigger tournament with more rounds. And Magic Online really helps you understanding the game, because the triggers are happening automatically, but you don't have to make to do it like automatically. It really helps you to get a sense of how the game works in detail on a rules based. And it's like a really good place to develop yourself on your own. And like, yeah, the next best thing is like play larger tournaments, go to them. Even if you're losing a bunch, just play in there, because in order to get better, you have to take losses.
Yeah.
you're not learning from the win. You're learning from the losses you take, and you're learning from the mistakes you are making. And if you're not allowing yourself to make mistakes on the bigger level against players who are better than you, then you will not get better on your own. You will just stay at your level and never get anything.
I love that. So play Magic Online, and I think that's a great resource. Like you said, it's really good opponents to be had anytime you want to log in. Play bigger events stood out to me as well, because you have to go and you have to, you know, take those losses and learn what it's like to, you know, be at those bigger events and things like that. I think that's really, really good advice. How has, because, you know, you've been playing for a long time and, you know, you've been in and out like many players, and that's totally fine, like we mentioned before, but how has your dedication to Magic impacted your life?
It has impacted my life dramatically. I would not be the same person who I am today if I didn't play Magic. The opportunity to meet all these different people from Germany, but also from basically every place of the world, is so great. The opportunity to travel that much, and especially what it did to my mind, because I used to be a nervous person. Say it like that. I was like really nervous for when I was studying from exams or something like that. And when I started to make PTQ top 8s, I was, of course, completely nervous all the time. And I was doing a lot of mistakes just because of my nervousness. And at one day when I lost in the quarterfinals of some event or whatever, I told to myself, who actually is profiting from me being nervous? Only other people. It's doing nothing great to myself. And I used that in order to get rid of this nervousness. I put myself in these spots, and when I started to become nervous, I just closed my eyes and took a deep breath and reminded of how it like logically works, and I should not be nervous. And after trying and trying again, I just lost every kind of nervousness. I'm basically never nervous today. Nothing can really get me out of my comfort zone, especially not playing. And it did so much. For like, even if you're like learning Magic, then at some point you're also getting into statistics and mathematics,
yeah.
Because of that's how card games work. And I'm also playing poker. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that, but that's also like the next point where you are going to get your mindset right. And this is transitioning into every part of my life, because I'm way more self-confident than I was before. I have a very rational point of view if I need to have it. And yeah, it's everything about it is great. I would never change it again. And if I would have a child at some point, I would always recommend play games, because it's the best thing you can do with your time. I'm playing at basically all the free time I have, no matter what game.
I agree. Like, there's so many aspects of Magic that really, you know, help us in other areas, like you said, you know, with your nervousness and just like with the math skills. It's just amazing how
also social things, like you're getting in contact with people. Especially back in time, I was like the youngest back when I started. Everybody else was older, so I learned so much from older people just by talking to them, not only about Magic, also about life. And I was always ahead of the curve, like, because the other people in my age, they only talk with people of their own age. So it really helps.
Excellent. So on your journey in Magic, it's been full of ups and downs, like every player has, and we'd love to dive into two moments specifically. One being your worst Magic moment. What would you say that is, and what did you learn from it?
I have to think about that for a second. The worst moment. Yeah, definitely. Once I lost the finals of a PTQ, in a limited PTQ. And I think if I just played that game correct, and I could have because I knew the entire content of my opponent's deck and myself, I just would have had a 90% shot to win. But I didn't get it at that point. It was a grueling day. It was like 8 rounds of Swiss. Every round was like until the end, always extra time, stuff like that. And it was the finals of that event. I was really exhausted. But if you're losing a PTQ final completely on your own because you did something wrong, is the worst. Because I don't blame it on luck, as say, but I'm blaming myself if I'm not sharp enough to win these. That was probably the worst moment.
What did that loss? I mean, what did that? What did that? How did that impact? You know, your Magic.
I was really upset with myself, of course, and that was one of the moments. All of these moments, and there are a lot of them. Everybody makes mistakes, and that's cool. And you have to also, you don't have to be upset with yourself too much, but you have to learn from them.
Right.
But these are like always the moments where you realize, if you have a good mindset, that it's not a, that there is luck, of course, but that there's so much advantage you can gain, and the luck or the disluck happens to everybody. But you absolutely have to make the best of it in order to be successful.
And so, looking back on that, what can you share with us so that we can avoid some situations? So you mentioned it was like a long day and the mentally taxing stuff like that. Any ideas or tips that, looking back, that you would have done differently that might have helped you win this last game?
Actually, if I'm looking back at it, these days are like that. They are like exhausting, and I can't even blame myself for doing that one badly. There's also time issues, because at the finals of a PTQ back then at like 10 p.m., people just wanted to be playing, and you don't have like another 15 minutes to think about the game before you start. So actually, I realized that I could have won this game way later in retrospect. I didn't even realize it right after the game. But like 1 or 2 days later, when my mind was clear again, I thought about it, and then I realized it. I did like how do you say it? I revised it. I did revision of these events. I cannot blame myself really, because like it happens. The only thing I could have probably done is doing more sports and being more fit, so that I would have maybe more more.
Yeah, I'm not like more stamina.
More stamina. I'm not like in a bad shape, but I don't know what I would have done about it, to be honest. Yes. It happens. Happens.
Yes, there are long days in Magic, and there are some things you can do outside the game, like you're mentioning, to kind of get you ready. That's you know, being fit and physically and mentally, those definitely play a part.
That's really important. Yeah. That's something I have to talk about later on. But I want to add another point. It's very important about how to think what I could have done against it, but I think it's even more important that you are just actually taking something from that away, that you are learning for the future so it doesn't happen again, and don't upset yourself too much.
So the flip side would be our highs. What is your proudest Magic moment?
I actually don't think that it's the Grand Prix top four. There are a lot of good memories. Probably. That's definitely the proudest one. I won the first PTQ. I top eighted, and on that road, I defeated Jelga Wiegersma in the semifinals, and also another very good Dutch player in the finals. And the deck I played back in time was a deck I built with a friend of mine. So we played our own deck, which was also like something you basically never get to do. And it actually was that good in the format when it was unknown that people have copied it later on and had like decent top 16 finishes with it on Grand Prix. And that's what was like really cool. Winning the first PTQ top 8 I ever made, beating a future Hall of Famer back then, and having my deck being played from other people at the Grand Prix level to success. Yeah, that was like really cool.
That's really neat when you put together, you know, a deck that does well and then other people pick up and do well with it too. Like, I bet that must be a pretty cool feeling.
It was a good deck in that format, definitely.
That's really. So what did you learn from that experience from winning a PTQ top 8, your first one, and beating some well-known players? Like, how did that impact your Magic?
That impacted it a lot, because that showed me that if I put effort into it, which I did before, then you get rewarded. And that showed me that it's not all luck or not all like random or something like that. But if you are like trying and you're doing your best, that you can actually get your dream come true. Back then, it was my dream to win a flight and play Magic at the Pro Tour, see something from the world. And that was the first time I get to experience that.
Nice. So neat. That's really cool. And, you know, so as you have gone and through and played Magic all over the world against all kinds of people, You've seen and learned a lot. We can tell. What would you say has been the biggest mistake that you see players make?
In general?
Yeah. Or this, just when I say, biggest mistake players make, what comes to your mind?
Okay. I get that asked a lot to myself. So I think people are making mistakes which are happening very regularly based on what level they are currently on.
Oh, okay.
For example, it started when you're a beginner player, you're making different bad mistakes than somebody who's on an already higher level. I think at the beginning of the game, people just don't realize how a game of Magic actually works, how the two decks are playing against each other, what position you are in, misleading that position, and don't have a strategy in order to win the game in the spot they are currently in. That's the one thing. And if you are getting better at that, I think a huge problem for a lot of players is taking mulligans. Mm-hmm. I think the decisions on mulligan taking are really bad in general.
Yeah, so let's talk about that then. How do you mulligan? How do you look at it? What are some ideas that you have around that topic that we can discuss?
Yeah. So since the rule changes and that you get to scry one when you're mulliganing, I think that you really have to mulligan most of the 7 card hands that are not actually good. Also, of course, it makes a gigantic difference if you know what you're playing against, like, say, game 2, or you just literally know what your opponent is playing, or if you don't have this information. Because, for example, let's say that you have that you are playing against a combo deck without creatures, or a control deck without creatures, in Modern, like Tron, and your opening hand is 3 lands, 2 Path to Exile, and 2 Lightning Helixes in a zoo deck without creatures. You can probably keep that hand in the dark, even if it doesn't have a creature. Also, that's a bad example because it's already really bad. But you just have to mulligan hands like this. Or if you have situational cards where you know that they are not good in the matchup you are playing, but you maybe have 1 or 2 less because you need them. Let's say you need a Path to Exile in order to remove the 1 Wyrmcoil Engine or something like that. These cards are dead in your opening hand. It's like you already took a mulligan. And that's something you have to think about. How many cards in my opening hand are actually doing anything? And if there are 2 cards which are probably doing nothing, then it's a 5 card hand.
And then in which case you should just mulligan.
Which is just mulligan, exactly. On the other hand, a different thing about it. Sometimes you have to take risks, but you have to know when to take risks. For example, if you know that your matchup is really, really bad, you have a horrible matchup, and you have a 1 land hand, which is awesome if you draw the 2nd land on the draw, or even on the play. If your win percentage in the matchup is already 30%, because that's how it shapes up sometimes, then you, in my opinion, you have to keep a hand like that, because it's way more likely that you're drawing a 2nd land in the first 2 turns, and then win the game with a crucially good hand instead of mulliganing it. But that's think about how the matchup works, how the games work, and what you actually start to plan the games in your head. How should they go, or how are they going regularly? And is my hand actually suited to cope with these situations? And if that's not correct, then just take the mulligan and don't be mad about it.
Man, that's really good things to think about. I love talking about mulligans because it's sometimes tough for people to wrap their heads around
really,
you know, what should
really
I do and not do, and yeah.
It's really difficult.
Yeah.
It's one of the, and that it comes with experience. Also a point which comes with experience. And that's, but actually taking mulligans is pretty good to learn if you are in a remind the matchups and give the people the relevant information, and you can discuss about hands. You can discuss about the probabilities, the ups and downs of the hand, and whether you should keep it or not. For example, I had a really difficult decision actually at the semifinal match against Steve Rubin. I was 1-0 down at the Grand Prix in London, and we of course had deck lists, and he only had 4 or 5 2 drops in the deck. It was not that aggressive. It was okay. And my hand had all 3 colors, but 6 lands on the play, and the 3 mana draw 2, where you draw 3 when you have the City's Blessing. I don't remember the name. Secrets of the Golden City, I think. And I kept that hand because I thought, okay, after drawing two in the second turn, I have drawn like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 cards until I hit my fourth land drop. I should be able to play something then after 4 more cards and get into the game. And it's not that important that I do nothing on turn 2 or 3. I figured that in this matchup, it was very important for me to hit my land drops to get to the end game because my end game was way better than his. Mm-hmm. And that hand did that. But unfortunately, I drew like in these 4 cards, I drew another 4 lands. So I had 10 land, 1 spell. That happens, of course. And after that, we discussed, with friends, we discussed a lot about the hands. And in retrospect, I would have probably taken a mulligan, looking at the deck list again, thinking about the situation. But it's a really close call. We really analyzed that hand a little bit more mathematically about the cards I could have drawn that still wouldn't have done anything. And in the end, I was also pretty close, even after not playing something on turn 4 and stabilizing that board. So if I just drew like 2 spells, 2 land there, which is like the statistical probability that mostly happens, I would have probably won the game, but that's like how it works sometimes.
Yeah, so true. Good stuff. Thank you for the examples. I love having specific examples because then we can really, you know, drive home the lesson. That's really helpful.
And also, it's true, like, that's something you, because it's a game of variance and the game of luck, there sometimes you have to make decisions out of your gut, and sometimes there's a decision that is neither right nor wrong. That happens really rarely, but I think this mulligan decision is an example for that. I don't think that I can say that I obviously did a mistake on keeping that hand. I also could never blame anybody mulliganing that hand.
Yeah.
That's like a judgment call, and you have to make it, and I don't think that there's a right or wrong decision. I think you can justify both of them, and just didn't work out for me.
So, again, through your experience playing Magic, I'm sure you've come across many instances of good and bad sportsmanship. And yes, that's, you know, that's a quality that we try to exemplify as prodigies. And, you know, winning with grace, losing with class, yes, you know, being fair, some of those qualities of sportsmanship. What does sportsmanship mean to you, Alex?
That's a good question. Like, first of all, I do obviously think that sportsmanship is really important, and especially that playing by the rules is very, very necessary, because cheating was a thing that was going on the proto for a long time, is of course still going on, and I personally think that that the ways of protecting people from cheating are still way too bad, and you should just never do that. I don't think that you are a long time being rewarded for cheating. But I also think it's important that while playing by the rules, you obviously have to call the judge when something goes wrong, even if you could fix it on yourself, especially on a Grand Prix level, because these things can add up. But you have to be sharp. I think that sportsmanship is not about not abusing things that the rules are actually allowing you. You should do that, in my opinion, and playing mind games with your opponent, stuff like that, even if it's close to the rules. As long as it's by the rules, it's fair, I think you should do that, because these are advantages that the game is able to give you, and you should take them.
Yeah, I think that's fair. You know, like, you know, if it's within the rules, you know, squarely within, yes, the rules, then feel free to do it. But if it's not, then don't. And don't tolerate others doing it as well. So,
like, for example, I don't actually know if that's within the rules, what I'm like. I'm trying to make an example. For example, if the opponent misses a trigger, if the trigger is actually, if it's better for you that it's not happening, I would not remind him. And if you actually want the trigger to resolve, I would remind him, and I would let him take it back.
Yeah, stuff
I think
like
that's
that.
Like, if he misses his own trigger, then it's his fault. And if I want the trigger to resolve, then the trigger will resolve. But if I don't want the trigger to resolve, then it's his problem. That's something you should have checked.
Right, right. And now, so, like you said, some things are, you can't do that with, like life totals, for example. That's, yes, a thing that are locked. And but yeah, you're right. Like a trigger, it's your opponent's responsibility to you know, to track that. But like you said, if it's more advantageous for them to remember the trigger, then you can always be like, oh, this triggers, and make that happen. But yeah, and that's totally fine. It's on them to remember, and in situations like that, that does fall within the rules, and you are allowed to not remind them. But then if you want, you can remind them. So that's a really good example of, it's within the rules and it's up to you, and that's, yes, totally fine. So, Yeah.
But in general, you should. I think a lot of people have a problem with, because their mindset is bad, they have a problem with losing and not be like a generous loser. Everybody wants to win, of course. And there are like points where it's really hard. For example, if the opponent just like had like, was like already losing and he drew like two, or it happens to everybody, he drew like the perfect two, three, or even four cards in a row in order to kill you, then sometimes it's, of course, really, really hard to keep your sportsmanship. And it's also understandable if the people are just, at that moment, they don't want to congratulate. They are just mad about bad luck, and that happens to everybody. But you just, like, you have to shake that off. You can be mad, like, 10 or 15 seconds, slap your hand on the table, and then you just should get over it and congratulate your opponents. Because in the end, you are winning by that just as often as they do. And it's, of course, it's sad if it's happened. If it happens to you in the match where you are getting to top 8 if you win, or in the top 8, but it happens. It happens to you, it happens to your opponent as well, so what can you do about it?
Yeah, like I said, it's okay to feel emotions. You can totally do that. Just don't let it rob your opponent of their victory, because obviously if you won, then you'd be happy and you want others to be happy for you, but yeah, you could feel through it, and that's totally fine, but then congratulate them and move on. Yeah.
If you're playing like Magic Online and you are playing like you're 4-0 in a league and you're playing the third game, whether you are going 5-0 or 4-1 and your opponent mulligans to 5, are you happy or are you unhappy? You're always happy about that if you're honest with yourself. So, and you forget these moments where your opponent gets unlucky. And you should not do that.
Yeah. That's good stuff. So, coming to your recent Grand Prix success, how did you prepare for that event? What were some of the things that you did leading up to it?
Actually, I prepared for most of the events. I played like basically a Grand Prix a month since Amsterdam. But especially for this one, I played a ton of Ixalan Unlimited, really a ton. I was really good at Ixalan only, sealed and draft. And with Rivals of Ixalan, I actually didn't have that much time due to work. So I was only able before the Grand Prix to play like, I don't know, like two or three seals and three drafts. But I realized some differences to the regular Ixalan Limited. But unfortunately, I did not have the time to prepare as well as I would have liked.
So what was the most... what was the most impactful, the most beneficial part of your preparation? What helped you out the most in the limited time you had?
So I tried to get the differences between Ixalan and Ixalan with Rivals. Actually, I think that the format got a lot better with Rivals because there were a lot of like more archetypes and more, like I said, less variants, especially. And I realized about some archetypes that got like better or worse. For example, the dinosaur decks, I thought it was unplayable before. And with Rivals of Ixalan, I think it was at least playable. Still not that good, but playable. The draft is different because you're starting with the Rivals deck and oftentimes you open like a powerful uncommon. And I think in that format, it's just good to go with it. If you open like the Merfolk Lord or the Vampire Lord, just go with it and try it. That makes the drafting easier for a lot of people. And like for the Grand Prix itself, because I drafted that deck in the second draft of the day 2, I was also already drafting like blue-white decks before. I had a lot of success with blue-white decks, not tribal, just like flyers, enchantments, and ground blocking. And these decks, the blue-white, they called it like then blue-white ascent decks, even without... actually ascend cards, they got a lot better. I think that archetype is really viable now, probably even one of the best archetypes, and I realized that during my testing.
Yeah, man, that's a really good point. We do a sealed league for the Prodigies every set, and we're just in the top 8 now of it, but which I'm not in because my deck was terrible. Well, no, I mean... The other people had really good decks and they played really well, but on the topic of blue-white, like, yeah, whenever I play someone with blue, you know, it's like Water Knot and, you know, other white spells to, you know, with prison effects, and I'm like, ah, you just can't fight through. It's just so tough when they have a good blue-white deck.
There never has been a set where that blue-white had that much removal. It's like Water Knot, Then the bounce spell is also insane. Yeah. The 3-mana thing that draws you a card. Then there's the bounce spell with Ascend that just puts it on top of the library for 2-mana if you have Ascend. There are like a 2 pacifism effects. So you're basically stacked with removal. You sometimes can't even play it all. And then you have like these evasive creatures. There's like a new creature, the 3-mana 2/2, that's okay. The flyer that gets +1/+1 with your attack. And they're like, in general, your creatures are really solid. My testing partner and me, we were actually really surprised about how good the 5-mana 2/5 flyer was. In every deck, basically. It just stops every attack on the ground.
Oh, yeah.
Or in the air. It even attacks back if you have another dinosaur. It's really strong as a combo.
Yeah. That's neat. So those kinds of... those kinds of observations were what paid off the most, you know, recognizing the difference between the two sets and then going into the Grand Prix with that knowledge that set you up.
Yeah. I also won like, what is it called? I won 2 bites at the day before the Grand Prix at the Grinder.
Yeah.
So I had a sealed deck there. I think the sealed in general, that's like a lot about luck. I also myself, I had like the insane sealed pool. I had the Tetsimok with the 4-mana red thing that searches it up. So the Forerunner.
Yeah.
The Dragon Forerunner with Tetsimok is just insane in his own. And then I had like, basically, I had a black-red aggressive deck with not a lot of removal, but really good creatures, and this Tetsimok combo in it. And I could sideboard it into a 4-color deck because I had a lot of mana fixing with even more bombs. So the sealed deck was really good. No doubt about it.
So when you're building a sealed pool, what are some of the things that you are looking for? Let's dive into that.
Depends. In Rivals or in Ixalan format yet? Or in general?
In general.
Like, the first thing is, if it's a set that is like core set, where you don't have a lot of mana fixing, or in general when the mana fixing is bad, you are inclined to go like 2 colors. And then mostly these sets are like tribal sets or sets that work on synergy. So first of all, when the set is about synergy, I look if I actually have enough synergistic cards in order to make that deck work. And of course, you have to look for the bombs. The bombs are the card advantage cards and just basically sealed bombs, like Tetsimok, for example, are in the end what is winning in sealed. But if you don't have any of these, you have to have a cohesive strategy. Like, you have to have a synergistic deck or like a really aggressive deck maybe that works for yourself in order to make the best of it. And if the format is like less linear, but like not with tribal synergies, more about like say Alara, for example, where you have a lot of different colors,
right.
Then you have to, at first I'm always looking at the mana fixing in order to see what I can even play in color combinations and what is possible. And then like try to build the most reasonable deck in these. Like often it's in sealed, it's like a lot about, for me it's a lot about card advantage, it's a lot about big creatures, not as much like in draft about racing situations. You just want to get ahead in cards of your opponent and then win with something.
Yeah, that's a good idea to look at your mana fixing and see what you can even support in your pool.
Mana fixing, like, in general, I'm just, at first, at every single pool, I'm just having a short look at the mana and how it works.
That's wise. Very wise. Excellent. So you went through your event and you made it all the way to the top, which is awesome. And how many pro points did that give you? How many pro points do you have this season?
I think it's 7 or 6. It's 5 for the top 4, right?
Yes.
5 for the top 4, and then I have 1 more point from another event, so it's 6 right now.
Excellent. And then you're going to go to the Pro Tour, and that gives you another 3.
Yes, so I need to get another 1.
Yeah, for bronze.
That would be excellent, because then I can actually play the RPTQs without qualifying for them.
Yeah.
That'd would be nice. Like the first step, and like depends on how the proto goes. But for myself, if people just want to talk or meet me, I'm probably going to be at almost every European Grand Prix after the Pro Tour.
Excellent.
So I have a schedule. I'm definitely gonna be in Prague. I'm probably gonna be in Stockholm. I'm definitely gonna be in Brussels. And like everything but Liverpool, I think.
Man, this is so fun. We love seeing you know, where our guests are going, what events they're going to be at. And that's really neat that you're close to, so close to bronze. So that's going to be fun to make a push for that and pick up that last point somewhere. And
yeah, actually, like bronze is not, it's only for the, I already have these two buys because of all the grinding. So the only thing it gives me is like playing RPTQs, which is of course nice.
Yeah.
And I obviously will, but it depends on how the proto goes. If the proto goes well, I'm going for silver, definitely. Yeah. But if the proto goes bad, I'm still passionate about the game. I love the game. I always loved it, even when I was not playing actively for 4 years. I just played once in a while. But if I get the chance to get back to something like, or get to silver or gold, I will definitely go with it.
And how are you planning to prepare for the Pro Tour?
Yeah, it's funny because the Pro Tour is during my Las Vegas vacation of this year. I'm going to Las Vegas for 3.5 weeks and the Pro Tour is in the middle of that. So I'm actually like 3 or 4 days in Las Vegas and then I just fly to Richmond and fly back there. So I'm probably starting as soon as Dominaria gets to Magic Online. Mm-hmm. I'm going to test with other German people that are qualified for the Pro Tour, like Sascha Schwarz, for example, or Daniel Grafensteiner. Maybe you know them.
Yes, the names are familiar.
Maybe you have... you have heard about these, especially Daniel Grafensteiner. He has like at least one PT Top 8 and a lot of good finishes in general. Yeah, we are probably going to exchange our ideas, play a lot of Magic Online since it's possible for this Pro Tour. Draft is going to be exclusively on Magic Online and like discussions with friends of mine and probably playing some on Magic Online against them. And yeah, I hope that I'm finished with my testing before I go to the US.
And that sounds like a lot of fun.
But I'm basically going to be doing it all Magic Online.
Cool. Well, that's neat. It's so awesome that we have, you know, these resources that we can turn to. Speaking of which, when you are keeping up with Magic, what resources do you turn to? Where do you look for information?
First of all, for example, if I want to test for a special format for a Grand Prix, say Modern, the first thing I do is look at the Magic Online decklist, the successful one. If you just Google Magic Online decklist, then you get to a page where all the 5-0 decks from the leagues and from bigger events on Magic Online are posted at the next day. So I just have a look at these decks to get a feeling on what people are playing to success on Magic Online, because the metagame there is changing very fast. And just get a feeling on what's like popular right now.
Yeah.
And from there on, I just... Modern is especially difficult because there are so many decks. Then you at least get a feeling on what's popular right now. And I think, move on from there. Choose a deck, start playing with it, and change it. And if it's not your style or it doesn't fit you, then take something else.
Cool. And for you, what would you say has been the biggest thing that... the biggest growth that you've experienced as a Magic player?
I honestly think that the point where I realized when I was worse, or I always blamed it on bad luck. And the point where I realized that I should never blame the bad luck, but only blame myself for bad play, and changing on how to get mad, basically, or how to get on tilt. Tilt is also a point that is in Magic, is prevalent all the time, and how to deal with it. So I realized that that I'm not getting better if I'm blaming bad luck instead of myself. And from that point on, when I really did that, that was probably the point. Yeah.
So. We've seen, through our discussion, how this realization has made you a better Magic player. How did this realization make you a better person outside of Magic?
You are getting way more. Now, how do you say that in English? I'm missing the word. Let me look up the word for a second.
Okay,
I have a translating because I want to give that exact term. Yeah. You are getting more even-tempered in your life. I think that's the right word. Even-tempered or probably balanced.
Mm-hmm.
Because you are... if your mindset is in this way, that you're focusing on yourself, not blaming bad luck or especially other people,
right.
you can translate that into your life or into your work. And not start everybody likes to blame others because it's way easier.
Yes.
If there's something not going right in your life, then you just blame somebody who said something and, oh, it's his fault and we can't do anything about it, idiot, whatever, and be mad about it. But actually nothing will change for yourself and nothing will change for that person. Besides, he's probably mad at you. So, if you are just blaming yourself in the first point and ask yourself, what could I have done to prevent this, whatever this is?
Right.
Then you are getting a way better person.
How has taking responsibility, taking ownership of your actions in your life, how has that impacted you in your life?
Again, please, I didn't get it.
So that topic, taking ownership of your decisions, taking responsibility for your actions and what happens, how has that made a difference in your life?
It completely changed the way on how I looked at things and how I solved problems, basically. Mm. Because if you're trying to solve problems on the back of other people or just getting your problems solved by blaming somebody else or just asking and never doing something on your own, will not work. And it will just harm yourself in your own growth. I think if you want to grow as a person and if you want to discover what you are capable of,
yeah,
and the first thing you have to do is be very self-skeptical and blaming yourself before blaming others. And I think that's if you realize that and if you're living by that premise, then your life will definitely change for the better.
And the mind is such a powerful thing. Like there's, so many studies that just look at the impact of, our mindset and whatnot. And when you have a victim mindset, it's just the things that happen and the results that you can see in your life are totally different than when you don't. And so when you're constantly blaming external forces, it's that, woe is me, bad things happen to me, mindset is that victim mindset, as opposed to having, taking control and owning your decisions and your actions and being responsible for what happens and just really trying to find, okay. And so sometimes it's hard. It's like you're sitting at a stop sign and somebody rear ends you. It's like, okay, how could you have changed that situation, right? But the people who go through that and really try to own every single thing that happens to them and not be in that victim mentality, like they're just the outcomes that they have and their outlook on life and the results that they get are just so much more positive. And so it's really fascinating to see how we can learn such a big lesson in starting in magic. Like it's just, I love how magic is life. It's such a microcosm for just so many things that we can learn and grow and be. And it's just amazing. So that's pretty cool.
And that's actually true. Like without the game of magic and the people, the game in it, in and of itself, and the people I met while playing Magic, I would never be the same person today. And I'm really grateful and really happy about how the things have developed for myself.
Yeah, love it. Now, as we pull into the home stretch, I want to remind the prodigies out there who want to connect with Alex, we're going to get him into the Facebook group. So mtgpro2.com/Facebook group, and we'll get him in there. You can make a post and tag him in it, and that'll be the best way to say hello or ask him a question or say thanks for being on the show. So, Alex, as we wrap things up, what is one final piece of guidance you have for us? Either something you already said that you want to emphasize or something new you would like to leave with us here at the end?
No, just one last tip. If you're actually trying to get better at the game and to learn something from somebody who is better than you, I'm like, I've offered people from my regular place here in Koblenz, just two of them who want to get better. I offered them to play with them at my house so they can come to me and play against each other, and I'm looking at their games. But it's also important like that I play. Or if you're having somebody who is actually willing to teach to you in order to learn something, I would recommend watching him playing, like Magic Online, let's say, and think in your head about what you would do in the situation you're currently in. But let him play. And every time he does something that you wouldn't have done, think about it. He's not always right. Probably you are sometimes right, but discuss about these things and try to get why he did something you probably wouldn't have done and why it's maybe better than whatever you did. And that's the way on getting good as fast as possible. Learning from best players, watching them play, and play against them.
Now, Alex, I want to acknowledge you for your contributions to the multiverse. And thank you. Thank you so much for coming onto the show, for sharing your stories and your experience and your time with us. You are a hero among planeswalkers, and it's been a blast chatting with you. May you never be mana screwed. Always draw what you need and depart every plane victorious.
Thank you, and thank you for having me here.
Alexander, thank you so much for being our guest on episode 280 of the MTG Pro Tutor podcast. Prodigies, you can find the show notes at mtgprotutor.com/AlexanderKreutz. That's K-R-E-U-Z. So look at the episode there for links to any resources that were mentioned, as well as the synopsis of what we talked about. And I want to close out by saying thank you again to Paragon City Games, who supports the show, proud sponsor, and they provide the prize support not only for the sealed leagues that we do for each set, but also for our monthly patron exclusive giveaway. And as promised, I am announcing the winner of March's patron exclusive giveaway, and that is, drumroll please, Ben Sissel. Ben, thank you so much for your support, and congratulations on winning the giveaway. You'll be getting a Rivals of Ixalan bundle provided by Paragon City Games, so a huge thank you to them, and Ben, a huge thank you to you. Thank you again for your support. I look forward to growing the patron community. There are some pretty fun things that will be unlocked as support for the show grows. And then based on your support level, you will get some of those unlocks. They include swag and tokens and more shows, things like that. So take a look at the rewards and the tiers that we have set up at mtgpro2.com/Patreon. And anybody who is at the Bed of Plants level or higher will be considered for our monthly drawings. And this month, once again, huge congratulations to Ben Sissel for winning the giveaway. An even bigger thank you for your support. Thank you, Ben. Well, that wraps it up for today. Thank you so much for joining me. I love doing these. Can't wait to join you again next week. And until then, I am Sean of The Gathering, and we will see you in the next cast.
This round of MTG Pro Tutor is over. So you don't miss a single episode of MTG Mastery. Be sure to subscribe to the show on your preferred podcast listening service for more exclusive interviews, deck building tips, and elite content. Or visit mtgprotutor.com to stream it straight from the source. We look forward to helping you think and play like a pro.